This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
My name is Adil Zaid, and I serve as the Muslim chaplain here at the Claremont Colleges. Alhamdulillah. Everyone, welcome to the Claremont Colleges. Welcome to our community guests, welcome to our students, our faculty, and our staff as well. We hope to have more events open in the community, to the community, because we are all one community here in Southern California. Thank you to our sponsors, the Office of Black Student Affairs, Pomona College, and Claremont McKenna College. Thank you to the McAllister staff, the MSA, the Claremont Colleges, our board, our new Muslim Life Fellow, Sundas, from the Claremont School of Theology, and a special shout out to Farouk, the MSA Vice President, for his tireless efforts for this event. Thank you so much. The topic today of history of Black Islam in America is a prudent one. African Americans have worked and given their lives so we can enjoy civil rights that we have today. As a son of immigrants who benefit from that privilege, I feel compelled to apologize in many ways for the lack of acknowledgement towards the African American contributions and specifically the African American Muslim community and what they have done for us, planting the seeds of Islam in America and building that Islamic infrastructure and reputation of the honor of Islam. And then when international Muslims came in to America, they moved out of the city into suburbs, forgetting about all the good that was done, and built their own mosque organizations and didn't act as honorable. We all such speak out against injustice in our society, killing of innocent Black men, the war on drugs, the target people of color, mass incarcerations, subjugating women of color, and so forth. And perhaps hard to swallow for many is the racism that we have inside the Muslim community. When it comes to marriage or inviting African-American speakers for comedy or for fundraising, but not as keynote speakers. Something that I've written about Huffington Post, and I encourage others to speak out on it as well. Switching gears, I'd like to introduce our MSA President, Zila Nbisma, who will subsequently introduce our signature speaker for tonight, Dr. Sherman Jackson.
Dr. Sherman Jackson is the King Faisal Chair of Islam and Thought and Culture and Professor of Religion and American Studies and Ethnicity at the University of Southern California. He was formerly the Arthur F. Tharnow Professor of Near Eastern Studies and Visiting Professor of Law and Professor of Afro-American Studies at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. Dr. Jackson received his PhD from the University of Pennsylvania and was taught at the University of Texas at Austin, Indiana University, Wayne State University, and the University of Michigan. From 1987 to 1989, he served as Executive Director of the Center of Arabic Study Abroad in Cairo, Egypt. He is the author of several books, including Islamic Law in the State, The Constitutional Jurisprudence of Shihab al-Din al-Gharafi, On the Boundaries of Theological Tolerance in Islam, Abu Hamid al-Ghazali's Faisal al-Tafrika, Islam and the Black American, Looking Toward the Third Resurrection, Islam and the Problem of Black Suffering, and most recently, Sufism for Non-Sufis, Ibn Atta Allah al-Sakandari's Taj al-Arus.
Additionally, Dr. Jackson is a co-founder, a core scholar, and member of the Board of Trustees of the American Learning Institute for Muslims, which is an academic institution where scholars, professional activists, artists, writers, and community leaders come together to develop strategies for the future of Islam in the modern world. He's also a former member of the Fiqh Council of North America, former president of the Shariari Scholars Association of North America, and also past trustee of North American Islamic Trust. He has contributed to several publications, including the Washington Post Newsweek blog on faith and the Huffington Post. Dr. Jackson is listed by the Religion Newsletters Foundation's Religion's Link as among the top 10 experts on Islam in the United States. However, as one of the Claremont College's co-president of MSA, I think I was obviously listed as number one. moving on, he was also named among the 500 most influential Muslims in the world by the Rural Islamic Strategy Studies Center in Amman, Jordan, and the Prince Al-Walid bin Talal Center for American Christian Understanding. Thank you, everyone, again for coming, and please welcome Dr. Sherman.
Thank you. first of all, thank you very much for that overly gracious and generous introduction. I almost began to feel so superfluous after the introduction that Adil made, and I was thinking about just tearing up half my lecture and going with what was left after that. But let me say this much. I think that I teach among the courses that I teach on the undergraduate level is Introduction to Islam. And I've taught that course for several years, beginning all the way back at the University of Texas back in the last century, and I've taught it ever since up until the present. And oftentimes I tell my students that I teach this course sort of as a chapter in American civics. I think that the topic of Islam in the world today is one that we as those Americans who will inform and make up the future of America cannot be ignorant of. We cannot afford to be ignorant of this topic. And in order for us, therefore, to be sort of responsible Americans, we have to know something about Islam and the Muslims that are in our midst. And I think that a key part of that is understanding the history of how this phenomenon comes into being in American space. My presentation, however, is going to be more historical with a particular inflection. We will get to some of the controversies that exist within the Muslim community further on, but I think it's important for us to be able to put all of this in some kind of context. So let me begin by saying the following. When we talk about doing history, history can be approached from a myriad of angles, and there are two basic criteria on the basis of which we can sort of judge how successfully a history has been written or narrated. The first is the degree to which a particular historian is successful at achieving what he or she sets out to achieve. In other words, that historian takes a specific issue within an historical context, and he or she seeks to speak to that specific issue. The other criterion is comprehensiveness, that is, how comprehensive a historian is. That is to say, the extent to which he or she covers all the personalities, all the dates, all the places, all the movements, all the institutions, all the events that have something to do with a particular historical topic as a general historical topic. Now, I think that probably owing something to our Enlightenment heritage, especially as sort of products of the modern Western Academy, the tendency is probably to incline toward comprehensiveness as the basic criterion for how well a history is done. And that has its advantages, but I think it also has some disadvantages. I personally am just a little bit leery of comprehensiveness as a criterion for assessing histories, because when we talk about being comprehensive, there's a liability that the role and perspective of minority groups will be overshadowed by those of the majority. The majority will just emerge with bigger voices, bigger roles, bigger legacies, and the minority can sort of be washed out or marginalized. In that context, my approach to the history of Islam in Black America is not and has never been one that seeks to be comprehensive. I wrote a whole book entitled Islam in the Black American. And by the way, some of you will see a critique of that book based on the extent to which it is comprehensive or not. And let me say here that critique, from a certain perspective, is a legitimate critique. From another perspective, it's sort of superfluous in that it holds the book to a criterion that the book itself did not seek to satisfy. Right? So my criterion is not comprehensiveness. I am not primarily interested in names and dates and places and all those kinds of things. My basic point of departure is grounded in the following. When we consider a number of uncontested facts about Islam in Black America, we come up with a number of interesting facts. Number one, America is the only major Western democracy that can boast a major contingent of Muslims who emerge out of the soil of America as native-born Americans. Now, this might not mean a lot to many of us, but if we look at virtually the entire rest of the world, if we go to Europe, for example, the overwhelming majority of Muslims in a place like England come from the subcontinent. The overwhelming majority of Muslims in France come from North and Sub-Saharan Africa. In Germany, they come from Turkey. This is not to say that there aren't smatterings of native-born indigenous Muslims, but they are a minority and something of an anomaly. But when we come to America, America is the first major Western democracy that produces a large contingent of native-born indigenous Americans. And that contingent is the Black American community. Now, traditionally, you know, this is the first time I've drunk water out of a straw as a speaker. This is going to be interesting. Now, as a part of our general imagination, given what we tend to know and or assume about the Black American community, there's a tendency to assume that this phenomenon, that is of the transgenerational existence of Islam among Black Americans, has something to do with the legacy of slavery. And this is not an outrageous assumption. We know for a fact, we have material evidence to the effect that a percentage of the slave population brought to America from Africa were Muslims. And this is not just a statistical assumption. We have actual Arabic manuscripts written by African Muslims, enslaved in America, in North America, not South America, North America. All right, we have those as artifacts. So we know that they were here. And we can name any number of them. All right? But that assumption runs into a particular problem. When we consider the fact that something on the order of 10 times the number of Africans enslaved and brought to North America, that which became the United States of America, went to Brazil alone. 10 times. And yet we don't see anything that even approaches the phenomenon that we recognize as Islam in Black America, in Brazil, or any place else in the New World. Right? Therefore, if slavery or the legacy of slavery explains the emergence of Islam in the Black American community, we would think that that phenomenon would be all the more present in places like Brazil and other parts of the Western Hemisphere where Africans were brought as slaves. And yet, we find no such thing. And so, this leads us to, or it leads me to, a particularly interesting conclusion. And that is that there is something uniquely American about the phenomenon of Black American Islam. Something that cannot be simply explained by looking at what goes on in Africa or what goes on in any other part of the world. There is something uniquely American about this phenomenon of Islam in Black America. All right? And that is a point of departure for me in terms of a history of Islam in Black America. Now, this is not at all to deny other factors that may have contributed to that phenomenon. I'm not saying that it is exclusively American. I'm not saying that at all. But what I am saying is that to successfully, and I think intelligently, understand the phenomenon of Islam in Black America, the American element cannot be ruled out. Now, let me say this much, and this is my own, and you know, I'm sorry, I can't do the straw thing. I think especially, and I'm not trying to be political here. I'm purely being as sort of academic as I can. Maybe that's not the right word either. But anyway, in the particular moment in which we happen to live, to talk about an American element in Black American Islam almost sounds like a capitulation, because the assumption is that Blacks have never owned America, all right? And never had ownership in America. And therefore, any kind of American element would be assumed to have been imposed by the dominant culture from without, right? That is not what I'm talking about. In fact, I don't subscribe to the idea that Blacks have always been sort of resident aliens in America, in the sense that they have established a unique culture, a unique identity, an inextricable Americanness to their identity that cannot be denied. All right? In fact, today, it might be fair to say, I hesitate when I say these kinds of things because they're over-inclusive, but we can't talk about anything without being, to some degree, over-inclusive. So with that caveat having been made, let me say this. We may be on safe ground to say today that there are primarily only two groups of Americans who are not typically asked, where are you from? And those two are whom? White people and Black people. All right? It's in that context that the ownership in America, that's what I'm talking about when I speak of this place of belongingness, all right, from which they cannot be alienated. So when I talk about the American contribution, I'm not talking about something that is imposed entirely from without, but something that emerges out of the communal existence of Blacks in America. Now, this sort of basic framework places two key concepts at the center of my analysis. And the first of these is the concept of Black religion. Black religion. Black religion is a concept that a number of scholars in the academy have isolated as a specifically Black American phenomenon. It is distinct from what we might call African American religion. All right? It is perhaps a subset of that broader phenomenon. Black religion is that phenomenon that emerges out of the slave experience. It's one that recognizes God as a divine power that exists outside our earthly realm. And yet, that divine power is appealed to primarily for the purpose of getting God to intervene in the crucible of American race relations. That is the core of Black religion. In other words, God is recognized as existing, and he is appealed to for his power and his goodwill to intervene, to straighten out this mess called anti-Black racism in America. Now, the Black Christian community as it exists today, we might assume that community to sort of just naturally have existed from the beginning. But that's not quite the case, all right? Blacks didn't really begin to come into Christianity, or that phenomenon didn't really reach full tide until the 19th century, all right? Until the 19th century. And when it did, there is a case to be made for the idea that Christianity in its early beginnings in America, in the Black community, and we know that there was such a thing as the Black Church, all right, as an entity, a separate and apart from the white church, all right? Black Christianity was, to a large extent, infused by the spirit of Black religion. And again, Black religion, as a holy protest against anti-Black slavery, coupled with this appeal to God to intervene in the crucible of anti-black racism. Now, to give you a sense of how not only pervasive, but how much continuity there was to this spirit, in 1964, a black American Christian scholar from the University of Pennsylvania, as a matter of fact, wrote an article in which he claimed that the majority of blacks still in America who sit in the pews of Christian churches are theologically less Christian and more adherent to black religion. In other words, Christianity was a vehicle that carried the spirit of black religion. And his complaint, as a matter of fact, was that the very detailed Christology, you know, the divinity of Christ and these kinds of things, did not quite seep in to the majority of blacks in the black church. Now, this is not a polemic, and I'm not saying I agree with Washington, but this is a recent analysis of what's going on in black Christianity as a continuity of that history that begins with black religion. Blacks turned to Christianity in part as a means of being able to protest this pervasive phenomenon of anti-black racism in America. And in my view, in contradistinction to those who argue that Christianity was always sort of an anesthetizing element, black religion, at the core of Christianity, was a very successful phenomenon in terms of its ability to critique and challenge white supremacy and anti-black racism. Right? So that has been a phenomenon as a part of the collective black communal legacy for a very long time. One that begins with the crucible of slavery. Now, how does Islam factor into this phenomenon? My thesis is that the overwhelming majority of blacks in America up until 1900 lived in the South. Right? And in the South, contrary to what's believed, blacks and whites actually shared more of a culture. Far more than in the North. Does that sound strange? Right? I remember when somebody said that I taught at the University of Texas, right? I remember going into the dean's office once and overhearing the secretary down there. This was a white woman who was very chic and very urbane. And I heard her say, well, you might can't go. And I, you know, use double modals like that. You might can. That doesn't, well, it struck me as being somebody from the North, all right? What I was shocked to find was that much of what I had assumed to be black English was not at all black English. It was Southern English, all right? Right? In fact, when I came to the University of Texas, I came to Texas from overseas. I had been living overseas, studying for a number of years. And when I came to the University of Texas, I still remember, they put me up in one of these hotels. By the way, I mean, at that time, I mean, I had been away for a number of years, and I come back, and this is the first time I saw one of those hotels, you know, with the fancy glass elevators, like, in the middle of the floor, right? I was like, wow. You know, it's like, you know, they had telephones in the bathroom and things like that. You know, it was a really fancy hotel because they were trying to sort of wine and dine me, you know, because they were trying to recruit me to the University of Texas. So anyway, I come down for breakfast on the morning that I'm go to the university to get my my job talk. And we sit down at this very fancy hotel restaurant, and we open up the menu. And I'm taken aback a little, and I sort of turn to one of my colleagues, they're all white, and I say, what's this? Right? And he sort of smiles at me and says, listen, I know what you're thinking. but no self-respecting restaurant in the entire South would be caught dead without this on its menu. What do you think it was?
Grits.
Grits! Grits! I know whites in the North and in the Midwest who didn't even know what grits were. All right? So what I'm saying is that what you have in the South is a shared cultural legacy. And this is not to whitewash the problems of racism in the South. Okay? But again, one of the sharpest dividing lines between black and white culture in the North is African language. All right? Okay? How you speak. All right? So what you have in the South is black religion, Christianity, and this sort of shared culture. On the eve of World War I, however, we begin to get this massive exodus out of the South into the North. All right? And this was fueled by a number of things. The end of slavery, the crucible of Reconstruction, all right? And then World War I, which produced all kinds of job opportunities, all right, for blacks from the South coming to the North, right? Now, once this happens, to make a very long story short, you end up getting a certain dislocation, all right, in the relationship between black religion in the South, all right, and blacks who are coming to this new urban center in the North. They're dislocated. There's an attempt to sort of try to adjust to this new northern phenomenon. And you get black church leaders trying to readjust so that they can find ways of maintaining the relevance of Christianity as it had been practiced in the South in this new northern metropolis. To make a long story short, some of this begins to break down. And black religion is released, in a sense, from the monopoly of Christianity. And to all intents and purposes, is sort of out there floating around looking for a new home. Right? This is the time period in which what I call the proto-Islamic movements attach themselves to black religion with a vocabulary and a set of institutions that are related to Islam. They still do not have a basic Islamic theology, right? Or even an attachment to the fundamental institutions of Islam. But they have a language and a basic sensibility, all right? And most important, a sense of ownership over this new construct called Islam. And here, I think we have to look at a phenomenon that's also quite important in the black American community. Part of what black religion provides to black American communities is the ability to escape the powers of definition, all right, by the dominant culture. By which I mean that the dominant culture, all right, which controls all the educational systems, which controls the media, which controls Hollywood, which controls all of the institutions that can produce and disseminate ideas and images, all right? Under those circumstances, you can be defined according to the way that the dominant culture wants to define you, right? And this may explain a phenomenon that I think we find uniquely in the black American community. This is a community that's gone through how many names? Right? Negro. Black. Colored. African American. Afro American. At one point on the East Coast, Bilalian. All right? Black American. Moorish. All right? I mean, in a sense, these are attempts to break the monopoly of the dominant culture over the definition of blacks. All right? So if you come outside the realm of the control of the dominant white community, you can end yourself, you can find yourself in a position where you are able to self-define. To self-define. When we look at the early proto-Islamic movements, we find an explicit attempt to self-define. All right? Notice the name of the first, I shouldn't say first, but the first really important phenomenon among the proto-Islamic movements. It is called the Moorish Science Temple. All right? Now, this name is not accidental. Okay? On the one hand, it is called Moorish. What is that all about? Okay? Not just Morocco. It is an escape from that. All right? In other words, the dominant culture in America, if you call it black, they can still what? Define it. If you call it Negro, they can still define it. If you call it African, right, they can still define it. What image of Africa, all right, has existed in the dominant culture up to very recently? I mean, Hegel called it what? The dark continent with no history, all right? Moorish, on the other hand, goes outside that. You don't own that, all right? So we can self-define as Moors, all right? But it's the Moorish, what?
Science
temple, okay? Why science? I remember, I speak freely, yeah, I'm tenured. I remember once I was being looked at for a position, I won't say the law school, at a prestigious law school. And I went out to dinner with the dean and a number of other people. And the dean was a white guy. And personally, I don't suspect this dean of having, you know, a cell of racism in his body. I mean, certainly not anything deliberate, all right? And we were sitting at dinner, and he said explicitly, you know, part of the challenge that black people confront in America is that the stereotype of the Negro, all right, is still intellectual inferiority, right? Intellectual inferiority. That to this day, I mean, I wrote something recently in which I basically said that, I mean, even in my own writings, all right, there are people who will quote what I wrote in Black Islam and the Black American, or who will quote what I wrote in Islam and the Problem of Black Suffering, all right, but not what I wrote about theology, but not what I wrote about law, but not what I wrote about jurisprudence. You follow the point? I'm an authority here. Why? Because I'm black, right? Why am I not an equal authority there? You see that stereotype? So when you say Moorish on the one hand, and then science, all right? We're breaking that stereotype. And then temple, all right? Because this is still a God-centered, and black religion is God-centered. You don't have black religion without God, all right? God is the object of appeal. Okay? So this is what we begin to get in that early proto-Islamic movement. The Moorish Science Temple takes place around 1913. And here I should say that when we talk about the phenomenon of Black American Islam in its formative period, we need to note the following, that this is a largely 20th century phenomenon. Largely. It is largely a northern phenomenon, an urban phenomenon, and a middle, lower middle to working class phenomenon, all right, as a sort of majority movement. Now, I know some of us, you know, when we say middle class, the lower class, or working class phenomenon, for many of us, you know, there's a stigma that attaches to that, right? Let me say this. I don't need the mic, do I? All right, I'm loud now. Let me say this. For any movement, any And in America, that culture has to be a popular culture. America is not Europe, all right? We are the land of popular culture. How many of you can name an opera singer? Don't say Pavarotti because he's in commercials. How many of you can name an opera singer? No. How many? Three, four, all right? Five, six. Some people are gonna cheat, right? Okay? How about a rapper? How about an R&B artist? How about Motown? How about Hollywood? You begin to get the point that I'm making here, all right? Okay? And in those areas, especially music, especially art, especially vernacular culture, those things are owned by working in lower classes, all right? And you will not get a real powerful popular cultural phenomenon, all right, out of academics. Does anybody follow my point there? So when I say it's a working in lower class phenomenon, that's not a slight. That's not a criticism, all right? That's just a fact, okay? So now we have black religion coming out of the South, coming to the North, and we move into these proto-Islamic movements. This brings into focus the second fundamental category that's important for my analysis. And that is the phenomenon of communal conversion. Communal conversion. And I want to stop and say a word about that, because it's very easy to be misunderstood. By communal conversion, I do not mean mass conversion to Islam. I do not mean that. What I mean, however, is the possibility of mass conversion. Okay? Now, what's the difference between the two? I know a white woman who's a Muslim and who wears a hijab. You know what I'm talking about, right? This woman has recalled how she can go to the mall, all right, and be approached by a salesperson and ask the following: where are you from? What's going on there? The assumption is that this means she can't be American, all right? And we wonder if she even speaks English. So let us enunciate, all right, so that she understands what we're talking about, okay? All right? What I mean here is that there is a sort of culture identity barrier between Islam and the majority white community, all right? Now, please, everybody, when I say that, I'm talking about the is, not the ought. Somebody understand what I mean by that? I'm talking about what is, not what ought to be, okay? All right? There's several manifestations of this, all right? White Americans who convert to Islam, all right, are often looked upon by their own white communities as something of racial and identity apostates. I'm sorry, I'm not trying to be offensive. Am I right?
Yeah.
Right? It's like, what the hell are you doing going and joining them? All right? Okay? And this identity barrier, all right, can be a major barrier to conversion to any religion. All right? No one wants to be alienated from their own group. Okay? What I mean by communal conversion, therefore, is a phenomenon where that cultural identity barrier is broken, it's crushed, it's smashed, such that one can embrace Islam while at the same time maintaining one's identity as an authentic whatever one came from. Do I understand the phenomenon? Right? In other words, I can be authentically black and Muslim. Alright? Okay? Now, again, once you have communal conversion, now what do I mean by communal conversion? I don't mean the actual conversion. Alright? But the possibility of that. Through the shattering of the cultural and identity barrier. Alright? Communal conversion is established, in my view, first and foremost by that movement known as the Nation of Islam. It was a proto-Islamic movement, not fully theologically in line with Islam, and yet it played a major role in ingratiating black Americans in general, all right, to an identity that was aligned with Islam, all right? And this was done through a major, major feat of appropriation, all right? Adil talked about, the coming of, I think he called them international Muslims. Maybe I can use that instead of immigrant. But international Muslims and some of the dislocations that came about as a result of that. What the Nation of Islam was able to do, all right, and everybody, I know there are all kinds of stereotypes about the Nation of Islam, but just read from the admin a little bit. just relax, okay? All right? I'm very serious, because again, the power of definition, okay, affects what we think about those movements as well, okay? The Nation of Islam is very important, and this is why I place them at the center of my history, because it is they who are more than anyone else responsible for the phenomenon of communal conversion, all right? Communal conversion takes place when, in fact, I'm able to arrange things, I don't know if arrange is the right word, produce a situation whereby conversion to Islam, in this case, all right, is not only consistent with being black, all right, but is perceived as being what? As something that makes me a more authentic black person. Does anybody follow that phenomenon? All right? The Nation of Islam, more than anyone else, did this. All right? International Muslims did not understand this phenomenon nor the importance of this phenomenon. They understood theology only. And that movement was judged based on theology only. And by the way, not just the international community, Sunni Muslims who were black as well, myself included. I mean, just for, what do you call it, truth in advertising, whatever it is. All right? All right? But this is a major, major phenomenon. And I don't think that the history of Islam in black America, all right, as the phenomenon that it is, let me try and give you a sense of what I'm talking about here. Herbie Hancock is a Buddhist, right? Tiger Woods, all right? Tina Turner. Does anybody follow what I mean by that? Does Buddhism enjoy communal conversion in the black community? Do you see the point that I'm trying to make? All right? Isolated here, isolated there, that's fine, all right? Islam enjoys such, and the Nation of Islam did this more than anybody else. Sunnism blew it. I'll get to that in a minute. This communal conversion affected not only people who became a part of that movement, all right, but the black community as a whole, all right? And I'll give you just one indication of that. By the way, I was there on the East Coast when these things swept through. I mean, the Nation of Islam, they put platform shoes out of business. They put Afro hairdos out of business, all right? And they developed a new persona, which I would call the BASP. The BASP, all right? What do you think that's a riff-off of?
WASP,
all right? The Nation of Islam produced an alternative modality of being black in America. A black Afro-Saxon Protestant with a small p. No, no, I'm very serious about that. With a small p. All right? Just imagine this. This is, I'm hanging some out if you think about it. How is it that a movement can produce a situation where the daily attire of Harvard law professors and Wall Street bankers, all right, which is what? Bow tie. How is it that this can be transformed into a marker of a Muslim identity? Does anybody follow what I mean by that? All right? You have a situation where these black men are walking down the street speaking proper English, all right? Shoes spit shine, all right? As confident as the day is long. And what do you say? There goes one of those black Muslims. A Muslim identity that borrows nothing from the Muslim world. A Muslim identity that is carved entirely out of American artifacts. Right? Black, Afro-Saxon, Protestant. Okay? And that is what goes a long way in promoting this communal conversion. Why? Because that phenomenon includes a very palpable degree of appropriation. All right? You know, there is a slur that you can hurl at black people that's worse than the N-word. Anybody guess?
Aria?
What?
Aria?
Coon?
Say it.
Uncle Tom.
Uncle Tom. Those are synonyms, basically. Uncle Tom. Does anybody follow that? What's an Uncle Tom? Huh? Wait a minute, y'all think I'm gonna do all the work, do you? Anyway, a collaborator? No, not just a collaborator.
A sellout,
a race trader. How do we measure that? Someone who recognizes the dominant way as the way. Anybody follow what I mean by that? Someone who recognizes the dominant culture's way as the way. Okay? And yet, what do we get out of this? We get black people, all right, appropriating not only middle class, but upper middle class and genteel ways as their own. Do I follow what I mean by that? Whereas they can walk down the street with three-piece suits and bow ties on, and nobody sees them as what? Uncle Tom, right? And were you to walk into a place and find another black with the same attire, not quite carrying that black Muslim ethos, you see him as what? You see the point that I'm trying to make? Massive appropriation. I don't know of any other feat of appropriation in American history like this. All right? And that goes a long way in ingratiating Islam with the broader black community. All right? I have a guy I know. He's a very wealthy, I don't say very wealthy, but he's a wealthy person, white guy, Catholic. He's the editor of a major, major, major Catholic magazine. And he said to me once, he said, I want to thank you for helping me understand something. I said, what are you talking about? He said, your book, Islam and the Black American, helped me understand something. All right? And by the way, I'm not telling the book, although. Anyway. I said, what? He said, I remember going downtown in Baltimore and encountering these black Muslim guys, all right? And being scared poopless, right? You know what he said. And being scared poopless. And then he said, but I want to tell you, I was not physically scared, all right? Because these guys carried themselves like too much. They were gentlemen. You follow what I'm saying? All right? I was not physically scared of them. What scared me about them is that they said with every genuflection of their body, all right? You see this three-piece suit? This is mine. I'm not trying to be like you. And the loss of ownership over that cultural sort of identity scared him to death. Mm-hmm. Do you follow what I mean by that? Scared him to death. All right? Okay? Now, this is part of the phenomenon that goes into the communal conversion that I'm talking about. All right? And this is why I place the Nation of Islam in the middle like that. Okay? Not because they're the most likable or the most orthodox or the most anything. We're trying to explain how Islam spreads among the black community. Without communal conversion, you don't get that. So you follow what I mean by that? Going all the way back to the 1930s, you had small black Sunni communities in America. In New York, in Pittsburgh, in Cleveland, all right? In various parts of the country, going all the way back to the 1930s. But they are not responsible for communal conversion. All right? Okay? This is where you get the phenomenon of Islam being looked to as a sort of more authentic expression of blackness than even Christianity. All right? And think about this. Even in the non-Muslim community, there's a phenomenon now in the black community. You can almost age somebody. You can guess their age by this name pattern. There's an IEI pattern. Huh? Lakisha. Huh? Shamika. You know that pattern? All right? These are all imagined imitations of Arabic patterns of names. All right? That come into the black community. All right? And that represent a more authentic modality of being black. All right? This happened. All right? And the problem with the international community, it did not recognize it when it came to America. All right? Now, communal conversion is in the Nation of Islam. Elijah Muhammad takes over in 1930 or 1934. He does this all the way up until 1975. As you can tell, I'm skipping a lot of detail. You want the details? Okay. All right. You said yes?
Yes.
I know it. We'll be here all night. But the point that I'm trying to make is this phenomenon is growing. And not only Elijah Muhammad. Elijah Muhammad went to prison for a while, all right, for draft evasion. He refused to go into the armed services, all right? It is said that it was his wife, Clara Muhammad, who held things together during his absence, all right? There are lots of personalities, okay, whose names we can't get into, who are behind the scenes. But we're talking about the general phenomenon, all right, of how this thing unfolds. So Elijah Muhammad is running the Nation of Islam from 1934 all the way up to 1975. Now, during that time, you get a number of sort of spin-off movements. For example, the 5% movement is a spin-off from the Nation of Islam. All right? The Ansar Allah movement is a spin-off from the Nation of Islam. But the Nation of Islam is sort of that central piece. Now, The Sunni community is still there. As I said, small, pretty much storefront communities. They don't really have that kind of national presence as the Nation of Islam has. Because the Nation of Islam has national leadership. It's a centralized sort of national movement. All right? The next big phenomenon occurs in 1965. Right? 1965 is important for a couple of reasons. One, the major popularizer of the Nation of Islam, Malcolm X, is assassinated, right? Malcolm X is phenomenal in terms of his importance, all right? Perhaps primarily as a popularizer of the Nation of Islam. Malcolm crisscrossed the country, establishing temples all over the place. And we don't have to talk about how Malcolm's articulations, all right, appeal to the broader black American community, all right, such that the broader black American community almost assumed a sense of cultural ownership in Islam, all right? And these things don't sound like very much, all right? But if you're trying to build a movement, all right, they're absolutely essential. Absolutely essential, all right? So what happens in 1965? Malcolm X is assassinated. That's one thing. That same year, something even more momentous happens. The National Origins Act is prorogued. Now, the National Origins Act goes back to 1924. In 1924, to make a very long story short, the Congress passed a law. And by the way, you know, we think that immigration, it's like, what's all this stuff about immigration? It's always been an issue. It's always been an issue. 1924 was an attempt to deal with the issue of immigration, all right? It was a very complex law, but to make a very long story short, it basically was designed to ensure that America would remain a country whose majority was from Northwest Europe. They didn't want East Europeans, all right? They wanted Northwest Europeans. And it's a very complicated thing, but basically it might be described as depending on the percentage of people from the country you're applying from that are already here, that's the percentage that's eligible for immigration. Do you understand what I mean by that? So if the English are 46% of the population in America, then 46% of the applicants for immigration are English. And down and down and down the line. All right? By the way, why do you think America is majority white? I mean, for the moment. You ever ask that question? Whites have more sex than blacks and Latinos? What? Why is America majority white? I'm sorry?
Everybody else has.
Okay? The immigration policies contribute majorly to this. Okay? In 1965, that policy was prorogued. All right? And there were two major contributors to this. One was the Cold War. America sort of woke up and sort of decided that we're really losing out to the Soviet Union. It was the Soviet Union then. All right? That we're getting brain drains out of all these Muslim and Asian and Middle Eastern countries, all right? But the Soviets are getting more than we're getting, all right? And this is not good policy. That was one incentive. The other incentive was actually the civil rights movement here in America. And the idea that just as it was wrong to discriminate against blacks on the streets of Selma, all right, it was wrong to discriminate against people of color applying for immigration. All right? And so the National Origins Act is prorogued. This opens up the floodgates for the parents or grandparents, all right, of many of the people who are Muslims in this room. All right? Now, I don't want to overstate things. I'm not saying that there were no immigrant communities or international communities before 1965. I'm not saying that at all. All right? And that's a documented fact that they were here. But in terms of this critical mass coming at a time, and this is important as well, when the Muslim world itself is in the throes of an Islamic revivalism, okay? All right? This is a very important fact or element in what goes on. We are coming now from countries where people are increasingly turning back to their Islamic roots, all right? Okay? As Islamic revivalism begins to unfold. This is the beginning of the coming of the international community. Now, so far, with some exceptions, black religion had been an element of the basis of authority in black American Islam. And by that I mean that Islam itself would be seen and interpreted through a lens, all right, on the basis of which it would seek to do the work of black religion, i.e. promote the health of the black community and protect, insulate, and empower it against the forces of white supremacy and anti-black racism, all right? That was simply a part of how Islam tended to be interpreted. Okay? So black, and the degree to which it was exclusively that or not varied from community to community. It would be more that way in that middle to what I call the super tradition,
the super tradition, which is the intellectual religious tradition of Islam, as the basis of authority. All right? In other words, now, if you want to talk about how we can address the issues of racism in America, now you have to do that on the basis of explicit arguments from the Quran, from the Hadith, from the Sunnah, maybe even from the schools of law. But this is now the basis of authority by which you articulate Islam. All right? Before, black religion would have provided much of the basis for how you articulated your plan of procedure. All right? But with the coming of the international community, there's a shift. And part of the reason for that shift is this. If traditional black Sunnis and the Nation of Islam are going back and forth about who is and who is not a Muslim, all right? One of the things that conferred immediate authority among or upon the international community is what? They come from the Muslim world. If they aren't Muslims, who is? All right? And yet, they, this is going to sound polemical, but it's not, all right? They only represented Sunni tradition by assumption. Does anybody understand what I mean by that? In other words, to put it bluntly, olive skin, okay, represented religious authority. Okay? If you looked like you came from the Muslim world, you were presumed to know what you're talking about when you said anything about Islam. Even if you didn't know what you were talking about. I'm being very serious about this, all right? Most of the people who came to America from the Muslim world were not clerics, had nothing to do with any religious training, all right? Nothing to do with it at all, all right? Of course, they had, you know, popular practices and certain assumptions. I mean, you know, Christians in America sort of know how to be Christians. You follow what I mean by that? I mean, but that's, don't get them any kind of theological discussion. They don't know anything about that. Right? This is what you had largely in the immigrant community. Now, the Shiite community is an exception. We'll talk about that maybe in the question and answer. But for the majority Sunni community, you had an international community coming with a presumption of religious authority. All right? Okay? Against the black American community, all right, who's now in transition from black religion to Sunni tradition. All right? And this leads to a relationship of domination, all right? Or potential domination. Now, what is domination? Domination, as I define it, are we going over time? Huh? No, let me wrap up real quick. Domination is a phenomenon where I take your story from you, and I give you a supporting role in my story, all right? And when you assume a supporting role in my story, everything that you do enhances me, even if it doesn't enhance you, all right? And this is sort of what happened in this early period. So for example, Palestine becomes a major issue. Police brutality is not, all right? Kashmir becomes a major issue, all right? Urban poverty is not. You see the point that I'm making, all right? And not only that, these become Islamic issues, okay? These cannot be defended as Islamic issues, all right? And this is the beginning of that tension that we find, you know, between the international community and the black American community, all right? And that tension is going on. Now, in 1975, Elijah Muhammad dies. His son, Imam Waraddin Muhammad, takes over and redirects that entire community into Sunni Islam. 90% of them. All right? Farrakhan stays and stays with the original Nation of Islam. But 90% or so come into Sunni Islam. All right? Here's where you begin also to get, however, a concerted effort on the part of black American Sunnis to learn that Sunni intellectual tradition, all right? So that they could get about the business of articulating Islam in America for themselves, all right? That phenomenon has reached sort of maturity today, all right? But in the interim period, all right, that tension remained, all right? Now, the next big thing that we get after 1965, or 1975, is of course, well, you get a number of things, but let me try to keep it short. The big one is what? 9/11. 9/11. Now, I have to be careful about how I say this, because it can be misunderstood and misused. 9/11 was a horrific act of terrorism, all right? And my training as a scholar of Islamic law says that it was an act of terrorism that Islam itself would condemn. No question about that, all right? Innocent civilians killed. No question about that. Publicly directed violence. Direct violence, you didn't even know these people. You just directed it at the public, all right? That is among the most severely punished crimes in Islam, all right? All right? So on moral and legal terms, according to Islamic law, 9/11 is condemned. Everybody follow that? And yet, this is where it gets dicey, but I'm going to say it. Because you need to be educated. 9/11 carried a certain silver lining for this relationship between international and Black American Muslims. All right? What was that silver lining? 9/11 forced that community to recognize, all right, a new reality. That all the presuppositions that they had brought from the Muslim world with them, all right, up to 9/11, America was an ideological playground. You could say anything. You could write anything. Don't believe me? Go back to some of the Friday sermons before 9/11 and see what you hear. Some of those who are Muslims here know what I'm talking about. It was an ideological playground. 9/11 put that to an end, all right? Muslims now have to be more disciplined in the way they go about their business. Not only that, not knowing, I mean, immigrant Muslims, let me say this, I have two more points and then I'll stop. Because see, you gotta say it, right?
Bring it.
No, I want you to like me.
You're relevant.
You see, here's part of the silver lining. America is a land of white supremacy. Now, hold on. I don't say that as a sneer, okay? You bad white supremacy, even if I believe that. That's not the point that I'm making, okay? All right? Okay, when we say in America, now, women like X, who are we talking about? Say it. White women. We ain't talking about Latinas, right? They don't even come to mind, if I follow what I mean by that, okay? White is normal. Normal is invisible. Invisibility is the greatest power you can have in any society. Somebody follow what I mean by that? Huh? Right? Now, you have this construct called whiteness with normal written on top. Somebody follow what I mean by that? Okay? Everybody that's come to America has tried to what? Get into that whiteness. Some of you would be surprised that some of the people in this room who 75, 80 years ago were not white. Irish, white? That you talk about. That ain't white. Jews, white? That ain't white. No, I'm very serious. I'm very serious about this. All right? Those are groups that became white. Italians. Do you realize that there were Italians prosecuted Under miscegenation laws, you know what miscegenation laws are? Mm-hmm. You can't have sex with white women. We would prosecute Italians for having sex with white women. Tony Soprano would have been prosecuted. You know, I'm very serious. I'm very serious, all right? So you have this construct, but the bottom border is perforated. You can get through. Everybody follow what I mean by that? So, Italians get through, right? Right? Lithuanians get through. Jews get through. Irish get through, all right? And guess what? In the early stages when they came here, guess who else was on their way to get into it? International Muslims. Everybody follow what I mean by that? International Muslims were on their way. Now, you have to understand something about the international Muslim community in America. This is one of the most educated, accomplished minority communities in America. Okay? Whereas, you know, Italians, you know, three generations ago, worked three jobs just to put the first kid through college. Everybody follow what I mean by that? Immigrant Muslims or international Muslims come through at the top. I was invited to a friend of mine in back when I lived in Michigan, invited to his house to have a meeting with some members of the Michigan Supreme Court. Now, you know what his standing is if he can get members of the Michigan Supreme Court just to come to his house, have a conversation, right? And he invites us there, all right? Okay, it's myself, because we're going to talk about the relationship between American law and Islamic law, all right? So, we're about to, you know, have our conversation, and before we start, the Chief Justice of the Michigan Supreme Court got up and said the following. He said, I'm English by origin. I'm English. My family has been here 300 years. And my kids keep asking me, Dad, when are we going to get rich? Okay? Now, why do you say that? Well, maybe it had something to do with the fact that my Syrian friend, whose house it was, who still had a thick accent, had a Ferrari parked outside next to his tennis courts, where inside his house, he's got an indoor heated swimming pool. You follow what I'm saying? And the Chief Justice is saying, first generation comes in like that. All right? It's a very accomplished community. And for that reason, it's able to establish institutions, all right, at a clip that's not as fast as the Black American community has been able to do. All right? 9/11, however, blocks that southern border. Even international Muslims who are legally white are no longer socially white. All right? That brings them into more of an ability to identify with their Black American brothers and sisters. All right? Those tensions are still there, all right? But that's opened up a kind of conversation. Trust me, Adil, I'm sorry to say this. I mean, what you said tonight, all right, we might not have heard that 30 years ago, all right? That's a very common thing to say today, not so much 30 years ago, all right? I get the feeling that my time has run out. I wanted to say a little word about hip-hop, but maybe that can come up in the question and answer, if we have any time for question and answer now. I apologize. Thank you very much.
Because it seems necessary, we are going to do a question and answer. There's another event here at 8, so we're going to try and get this done in like 20 minutes. My name is Paul, or from either one. So, that being said, you're an academic, and I think fielding questions from the crowd might be something you're used to.
Okay.
And we also don't have an extra mic. So if y'all can talk loud, that'd be great. And let's do this until, like, let's say 7:15. If we have that, any questions? If not, we're good.
Yes. Yes, ma'am.
I'm not sure if this is allowed, but I have two questions.
Okay.
So my first question is, you mentioned the 5% Nation as a spinoff of Muslim Islam.
Yes.
I don't really know much about the 5% Nation, but I wanted to ask why you think there was this spinoff, like why they're worse than us with the Nation of Islam? Like, was there a dissatisfaction with their country? And then my second question is, in your research, how have you observed relationships between Black international Muslims, like Nigerian Muslim, Somalian Muslims, and Black American Muslims?
Yeah. Okay. The first question is that we have to take these kinds of piece by piece. There's a very specific story, that goes along with the breaking off of the 5 percenters from the Nation of Islam. Clarence 13X, who founded the 5 percenters, was originally a member of the Nation of Islam. He was caught one day teaching unauthorized lessons of the Nation of Islam. He was rebuked for that. That ultimately led to his decision to go a separate route and start something different, right? Something similar happened with the Ansar Allah community, right? So you have schisms within the nation that ultimately result in spin-off movements that become their own thing. Right? Does that end?
Yes, it does. So it split off like as an individual who then
establishes another movement.
Oh.
Yes, yes. As for the relationship between African and Black American Muslims, it varies. There's a colleague of mine, Zain Abdullah, who's at Temple University, who's written a book called Black Mecca. And it's about the relationship between Black American and African Muslims in Harlem. And some of the same tensions exist. Right? There's harmony and there's tension. Okay? And part of that, also is related to the fact that, to some extent, Black American Muslims are still sort of in the process of crafting their own understanding of how to take ownership in America. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Can you elaborate on hip-hop?
Well, I think that what I would say about hip-hop is the following. We talked about the importance of Black religion as a sort of a basis of authority for the articulation of Islam in the Black community. Coming into the 90s and then the 2000s, there's some question as to whether Black religion is even still alive, right? Both in Christianity and Islam. And there are some who might argue that whereas Black religion may have been the wavelength upon which Islam traveled in the past, it is now hip-hop, all right? Hip-hop is now the preserver of a quote-unquote Islamic identity, even if it's not a purveyor of Islamic ideals necessarily, all right? And how do you teach it? Does that make sense? All right, in other words, look, it has been said, not by me, it has been said, that Islam is the unofficial religion of hip hop, right? But again, the question becomes: is that more as identity, all right, or actual practice? Does anybody understand what I mean by that? And I think that what's important from my perspective is that we don't make the same mistake with hip hop that we made with the Nation of Islam, all right, and throwing out the baby with the bathwater. Okay? Because the Nation of Islam was irregular in terms of theology, all right, certainly under the influence of the international Muslim community, all right, which large segments of the Sunni Black community were gravitating toward, all right, the entire nation was dismissed. Big giant mistake, all right. Identity is important, all right. Identity is important. A young Pakistani, a former student of mine, said the following to me. She said, "Look." I know that some of these like young Black American Muslims who are like hip hoppers, I know that their Islam is not like necessarily practiced in the way that it's supposed to, all right? But they strongly identify as Muslims, okay? And she said, look, if these people make it through their 20s, the 30s will bring something different. But in other words, their Islamic identity sustains them through their 20s. By the time they hit their 30s, practice will begin to catch up. It's just phases of life, right? And she said to me, those in the immigrant community, on the other hand, all right, when they lose their Islamic identity, there's no place else to go. They're gone, all right? So I think that that's an important thing to recognize as well. But we can go down the list of, you know, people identified with Islam or who are Muslims, who are hip-hoppers. You know, from Mos Def to Lupe to Ghostface Killah, I mean, you can just go down the list, all right? And the percentages, I think, are disproportionate. Disproportionately high. All right? Yes?
I have actually two questions. The first question is kind of related to, you said that the Nation of Islam was the main core that had basically a mass conversion of bringing the African-American community.
No, I would not word it like that. I would say that the Nation of Islam produced the redefinition of Black American culture and cultural identity,
okay,
such that the barrier between Islam and Blackness was shattered.
Okay. So now, knowing that perspective, now after 9/11, everything, all the immigrant community got blocked off, but the Black
got blocked out. Uh huh.
The Black community still stood strong. Now, going forward, what is the identification of being an American Black Muslim, or at least just an American Muslim? Like, for example, the women wear the hijab, you can instantly tell that that's a Muslim. Men, maybe some wear a beard, some don't, some, it's all over the place. So for the man, like, for example, in Nation of Islam, you had the bow tie, the suit, everything that identified, you knew that that was a Muslim. So what is the next phase that you see that of integration between the African-American community and the international community that can identify itself as an American Muslim?
You really want that? No, because you know, we want it when the FBI shows up. But then when we get back to the mosque, all right, we want to sort of be the real Muslims, as opposed to those converts. You follow? So let's just be honest about what we want. Let me ask you a question in a bit of a different way. I think that there are some developments that I haven't had a chance to talk about, but that impinge directly upon what you're talking about. One is that both the international community, and I would argue to a slightly lesser degree, as well as the Black American community, abused Muslim tradition, all right, to the extent that it alienated large segments of the Muslim population. All right?
What do you mean by that?
I mean that if you go across college campuses, across the country, all right, as I have in my young years, all right, you will be shocked to encounter the number of young Muslims, all right, who actually see themselves as believing, practicing Muslims, but who are scared to death of their own religious tradition. All right? Because of the manner in which it's been used sort of to control and dominate as opposed to empower. All right? And what this is now producing is a new generation of Muslims, Black and immigrant, who are searching for alternative sort of bases of authority, all right, by which they can articulate a mode of Islam. All right? So you have this sort of clerical, quote-unquote, activist divide now. All right? That is partly the way, a function of the way that tradition has been handled. All right? And there, the fault on both sides. I don't want to, you know, it's not all the clerical side's fault. All right? In fact, that leads me to the next point that I want to make. We have another problem in this country. And I think that we're not aware of it. You know, you have to be aware of the fact that I don't care where you come from, if you're in America, all right, part of your religious history, a major part of your religious history, is the history of Europe. Okay? because that religious history comes to America with the early Americans. And part of that history is that religion is a problem. And religion is something against which society has to be protected. All right? And the liberal epistemology of the Western Academy, all right, is such that it wants always to domesticate religion so that it can never challenge the state or the dominant culture, and it breaks down communities into individuals, radical individuals. The kind of thing that you're talking about requires precisely what many Muslims are unwilling to do, and that is shut up, sit down, and go along with the program. No. I mean, that can be abused. Please don't misunderstand me. All right? But you don't imagine for one moment that the Nation of Islam, for example, all right, could do all the things that I'm talking about doing, all right, without an effective hierarchy. Does anybody follow what I mean by that? You get me? Now that makes me sound like I'm one of these Bolsheviks or something like that, right? No, that's not what I'm talking about. Okay? But if you want to talk about this right here, could become the new Muslim guard. Do you follow what I mean by that? All we have to have is King Jackson or Amir al-Mu'mineen Jackson, who says, that's it. You go there and you buy it tomorrow. This is what I want you to wear every day. You hear me? You hear me? And when people hear you say Assalamu alaikum, they're going to see this. When people see you pray in public, they're going to see this. When people see you walking with your wife, they're going to see this. You see what I mean by that? Yes. And over a period of time, what happens? This becomes what? You follow what I mean by that? But we don't do that, are we? All right, then. So make up your mind. No, you can't have cake and eat it too. I hope that answers your question. Yes?
What institutions, cultural or spiritual, of Black American Islam survived after Imam Ali Muhammad shifted the majority of followers towards the Islam?
Oh, I think that all of them survived. I think that a couple things. I mean, again, some of the things that I talked about in terms of, I mean, look, we don't. When you talk about institutions, how can I put this without getting too academic? We don't live in a vacuum, is what I'm trying to say. Okay? And so when you get developments such as, you know, the rise of social media or something like that, all right, where you don't have any control over what your flock, let's say, you know, has access to, all right, you get people who emerge as authorities, all right, with very questionable qualifications and all these kinds of things. And this is going to have an impact on the texture of the community that you live in. All right? Now, you can talk about what institutions, you know, remain, all right? But how do those institutions relate to all of this? All right? And so there's much thought going on to these things right now. And I think that while many of us may get the impression that, you know, my presentation of Islam in Black America is somewhat bleak, I don't see it that way at all. I'll tell you a little story. I have a nephew who's a Muslim, young, you know. I give him a C. No. You know, I'm not. But the day after 9/11, schools were closed. The second day after 9/11, schools were open. This boy was about 12 years old. You know what he did? He went to school, public school, with a thobe on. Meaning what? What? Say so. What? Say so. No. You get my point. That's still a part of the Black American Muslim community. All right? And I think that for me, I mean, social media is a problem, not simply because of the emergence of quote-unquote authorities of questionable qualifications, but because of the destruction of etiquette. It leads to internal bleeding. Did you follow what I mean by that? You know, you and I can have a... See, put it this way. If you get up and just call me the N-word, straight up, all right? I'm not saying it would be like a good thing to do, but I don't think that very many people would blame me, huh? If I told Cocker. No, you follow what I mean by that? Okay? In other words, an open defense elicits an open response. You follow what I mean by that? When your offense is not open, it's just a slight. It's a diss. You follow what I mean by that? See, I can't even address you because the first thing I have to do before I can address you is admit that you hurt me. And I'm not going to do that. So I'm just going to bleed internally and hate your guts forever. Does anybody follow what I mean by that? This is the kind of thing that's going on all the time now among Muslims. Among everybody, but. Right? This is a major challenge. It's a major challenge. So to me, a major challenge is just getting etiquette, manners, edep, back into the everyday practice of Islam. Well, we can differ strongly, all right? But differ in a spirit of brotherhood, sisterhood, and respect. That's enormously important, okay? Because if you damage me on that little tiny issue, when the big issue arises, we can't cooperate, because trust is gone. Right? So it's not all these, you know, and I'll say this probably, good, 5 minutes. You know, everybody's looking to the scholars and the imams and, the activists and all the leaders. They have their role, but so do you. You understand what I mean by that? In fact, you can do that in ways that they can. I saw a commercial one time, and I'm just saying this because it really hit me. I can't remember. Some of you may have seen this commercial. There's a white guy sitting in an office. He's doing a job interview. He's interviewing people for a job. There's a Latino guy sitting on the other side, right? He's interviewing for the job. Okay. So the interview ends, and the Latino guy gets up and goes out. Okay. Another white guy comes in and says, "So how did it go?" He balls up the Latino guy's resume and throws it in the trash, and says, "I think we got enough color around here," right? The second white guy reaches in a trash can, takes out the resume, slams it down on the desk, straightens it out, and says, "I think he lost something here." Mm-hmm. You follow what I mean about that? That one act, you follow what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Says that this is not acceptable. We won't put up with this. All of us can do this. Does the Bible follow what I mean by that? You don't have to be no sheikh. You don't have to be an imam. You don't have to be a scholar. You don't have to have a PhD. Brother, that's not right. Sister, that's not right. You can't talk to people like that. Does the Bible follow what I mean by that? We can all do that. Okay? And if we fail in that regard, it's not the scholar's fault. It's not the activist's fault. It's not the sheikh's fault. It's our fault.
Dr. Jackson, you mentioned the Shia contrast with African American Muslims.
Well, I would say that the Shiites have always had a much more structured hierarchy. And that has made for a number of differences within the Shiite community relative to the Sunni community. And I think that as well, the Shiites had certainly, you know, going back to, you know, where I used to live in Michigan, in places like Dearborn, they had clerical presence, you know, from very early on, right? So that's one of the differences between the Shiite and the Sunni community. Yes.
You mentioned earlier how the Nation of Islam and the traditional Black Sunni Muslims, there's kind of obviously like a difference in theology, and you're saying that this could be considered completely theology or whatever. But was there a discussion or attention in terms of who was more Black between those two groups and outsiders?
Yeah, I guess around the edges. I guess, and it probably depends on when you are, but I guess around the edges, the Nation of Islam would probably claim a quote-unquote more Blackness, whereas traditional Sunnis would say, oh, we're Black, all right? But Blackness is not the measure of Islam. So you get, you thought you...
Yeah.
So, but you get those tensions, yeah.
I think we should do one more.
How do you see the role of women in the coming together of these two communities, the Black American community?
We washed our hands and stuff, cut up a whole bunch of fruit for you guys. Sitting out there in the hallway, we got mangoes, we got guavas, we got everything. Please take some. There are plates out there and forks for you. And thank you guys so much. It means a lot that you showed up.